From Cherokee to Currituck, from the largest city to the smallest town, and from the state house to the schoolhouse, it's Carolina Journal Radio, your weekly news magazine discussing North Carolina's most important public policy events and issues.
Welcome to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. During the next hour, Donna Martinez and I will explore some major issues affecting our state. More than 1 year into Donald Trump's term in office, it's fitting to discuss his disruptive presidency. You'll hear from the North Carolina State University professor who uses that label for Trump's administration. State lawmakers have concerns about mental health issues in county jails across North Carolina. You'll learn why and what they hope to do about it. History books often tell us about the role of the medieval Jewish moneylender. An NC State professor joins us to explain how that role is based more on myth than fact. And we'll document the military's ongoing concerns about the Amazon wind farm in eastern North Carolina. Those topics are just ahead. First, Donna Martinez joins us with the Carolina Journal headline.
In May, the North Carolina General Assembly will be back in session, and education issues are once again expected to be front and center for a variety of reasons this time around. Dr. Terry Stoops is the John Locke Foundation's Vice President for Research, the Director of Education Studies. He's here to take a look at what we might expect when lawmakers return. Terry, welcome back to the show.
Thank you.
We've had a lot of issues of safety on school campuses for obvious reasons, things that have happened in our country over the past couple of months. Is safety going to be addressed by lawmakers?
Absolutely. And really the question is, as they explore these issues in an interim committee, which way will they go? Will there be a move to try to arm teachers? I think that's very unlikely. I think the most likely outcome that we'll see is that they'll decide to put more money into school resource officers. These are basically police officers that serve full-time in a school. They're armed, and they are trained to be able to deal with difficult situations, ranging from small infractions of student misbehavior to real serious problems where there's an actual threat to the school. Mark Johnson, Superintendent of Public Instruction, and Governor Roy Cooper both agree that there needs to be more money for school resource officers. I think we're going to see a move in that direction. Some of the other opportunities to provide different types of ways to secure schools, such as ID cards or metal detectors, I think that's very unlikely that the state is going to move in that direction.
Those would be more local issues, would they not, in terms of construction of schools and security on individual campuses? Wouldn't that be local school boards anyway?
That's absolutely right, although school boards are expressing difficulty having the funds available for these sorts of measures, which is why the state would probably be more likely to step in and say, we're going to provide additional support for staff and maybe some other measures because localities are having such a difficult time dealing with some of the capital pressures on capital expenditures, that is, creating school buildings that are safe or creating, say, entrances that are more secure than they currently have.
Terry, we've also been hearing some interesting discussion about the size of North Carolina's public school districts. We know that Mecklenburg County and Wake County are humongous. I think some of the biggest in the country. Mm-hmm. And there are some parents who believe that school officials, even though their motives would be certainly noble, simply are out of touch with parents and kids because things are so huge. We're going to see that discussed?
I think we will see it discussed. I'm not sure that there will be legislation proposed, but first of all, I'm really glad that the legislature is actually taking this up as an issue because it really is the case that we have districts that are so large that they have difficulty being able to provide the very basic types of services for students in an economical way. You get a certain economy of scale depending on how large of a school district is, and you can get some economic benefits from that. But but these districts are so large, you have diseconomies of scale, which means it's actually more expensive to provide some services. Transportation is a good example to students who are in these districts. So the question is whether they are too large and whether the state or local government have a role in being able to look at different ways of configuring the school district to make it more efficient. Because really what we want to do is we want to maximize student achievement. And if there are structures in place, including the size of the school district, that's preventing that from happening, then maybe there is a legitimate role for the state or local government to come in and to take some sort of action in making sure the district is a manageable size.
I'm glad you brought up transportation, because I know a few years ago, particularly in Wake County, I think this has happened in other counties as well, there was a big hubbub over the amount of time that kids are spending on school buses, some of them being picked up, especially during the winter time. It's pitch black outside, and parents are saying there's got to be a better way. Is transportation maybe one of those hot-button issues that will get people to say, this really affects families, and we need to take a look at this size issue?
It definitely will be in a Wake and a Charlotte-Mecklenburg. That discussion, though, interestingly enough, has died down now that gas prices have gone down. When gas prices were higher and the amount of money that it took to fuel a bus was increasing significantly, then you heard a very serious discussion about the cost of transportation. But we still have instances where the kids are picked up very early, where the commute from their house or their bus stop to a school is 45 minutes to an hour. And we need to consider whether there is a detrimental effect on student achievement when kids are spending an hour and a half, 2 hours a day on a bus, rather than being able to go to a school that's closer to their home and provides more opportunities for parent interaction at the school that they attend.
We also now have some lawmakers who are interested in really taking a look at kind of a broader issue, and that is how we actually fund education in North Carolina. They've been meeting about that, haven't they?
They have, and they've had very productive meetings about really how should we fund North Carolina public schools, and that includes charter schools as well. And are there better ways to do it? Are there other models in other states that could be adopted here in North Carolina or modified to make it a more transparent, fairer system to the schools that receive money from the state? I don't think we're going to see legislation necessarily advanced during the short session, but I think most certainly we will see legislation advanced for the long session that comes in January. There may be slight modifications to the way that the current funding system works based on these discussions. So while we're not going to see an overhaul of the way we fund public schools in North Carolina, we may see some tweaks during the short session that will move us closer to a different sort of model, a more transparent, accountable, and fair model of funding students that will come in a proposal next January.
Some people might be thinking, well, that's easy. Let's just say, okay, right now, we're giving you this amount of money and you use it for this. And what's the big deal about changing that? This gets really complex. You've written some things that are really you have to read two or three times, not because of anything about what you've written, but because it is so involved how the funding system works.
Yeah, right now, there are 37 pots of state funding that we try to put money into and then allocate it to the districts that have flexibility to be able to move the money around. And then when you look at – you model some of these other funding methods, you see that some school districts are big winners, some are big losers. And so you have to deal with the fact that if you have school districts that would be losing money under an alternative funding model, then you lose the support of the legislators that are in those areas, and you may find it completely impossible to pass an alternative means. So you would have to find some way to cushion the blow if there were significant changes to the funding that would flow to these specific schools. I think the idea is to create a funding system that provides just about the current level of funding that the schools receive now, but in a more transparent way. So we can look at a school, look at a student, and know exactly how much we are spending on that student. Because one of the dirty secrets of North Carolina public school finance is that while we can estimate how much we spend as a state per student, we don't know how much we spend per student at individual schools. So we know that District X spends $8,000 or $9,000 a kid, but we look at schools in that district and we cannot determine how much per student we spend at that district. If we provide an alternative funding model, maybe that would be possible, and we can hold schools more accountable rather than districts.
Lastly, Terry, are you expecting any issues about school choice or public charter schools to come up in the legislature?
I don't know that we're going to see much in the way of school choice legislation. What we will see, in addition to the things mentioned earlier, are the three biggest areas, and that's teacher pay, teacher pay, teacher pay. We always hear about teacher pay increases. I think it's very likely that we'll see some sort of move toward an increase in teacher pay. And there might be small tweaks to our current and choice offerings, but I don't really see there being any large-scale changes.
We've been talking with Dr. Terry Stoops. He is the John Locke Foundation's Vice President for Research. You can read all of Terry's work at johnlocke.org and carolinajournal.com. Thank you very much, Terry.
Thank you.
Stay with us. Much more Carolina Journal Radio to come in a moment.
Government plays a key role in your life, affecting your paycheck, the way you educate your kids, the way you do business. How can you tell if government is doing a good job, making the right choices, spending tax dollars wisely? CarolinaJournal.com tackles those questions every day. The John Locke Foundation publishes Carolina Journal in print each month and on the web each day at carolinajournal.com. You'll find exclusive investigative reports on topics no one else is covering. What else? A rundown of the best news stories, editorials, and opinion columns in North Carolina. John Hood's Daily Journal. News stories and important public events at carolinajournal.tv. And the voices of the newsmakers themselves at Carolina Journal Radio. In print, on the air, and on the web, you can find the information you need at carolinajournal.com. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. No one really knew what to expect when American voters sent Donald Trump to the White House. But now that he's logged more than a year in office, we can step back and assess how he and his administration are performing. Our next guest has analyzed Trump's first year. Andrew Taylor is a political science professor at North Carolina State University. Thanks for joining us again.
Thanks for having me, Mitch.
So in a recent presentation for the John Locke Foundation, you discussed this as the disruptive presidency. What do you mean by that?
I mean disruptive in any sort of meaning of the word that you can think of. Just go through the dictionary and look at all the synonyms. And those can be taken both positively and negatively, of course. It's wild, it's unruly, it's antithetical to the status quo, it's troublesome, it's disorderly, you name it. I think we mean that when we talk about the Trump presidency being disruptive. It's very, very different from any presidency that we can think of, at least in the modern era.
A lot of people, as Donald Trump went into office, were pretty scared about what we could expect. After we've seen him in action for a year, are there still reasons to be fearful of the Trump administration, or do we see a little bit more of a pattern that's become predictable?
Well, unpredictability has become what's been predictable, of course. I think where perhaps the more genuine concerns of people are, regardless of where they sit on the political spectrum, aren't necessarily to do with substantive policy matters. I mean, obviously, there has been a tremendous amount of change with regards to policy. On the domestic side, we see a lot of deregulation. We've had the big tax cut. On the foreign policy side, we have changes in immigration and trade policy. We have a different sort of approach to national security. It's not that so much, I think, that people who have genuine concerns are worried about. It's more in the sort of style or the administrative management approach of Trump. And there's a sort of basic concern, which isn't really an alarmist concern, and that is that the there's sort of instability in the administration. We're not quite sure about its direction. And then there's perhaps a more sort of that might be genuinely alarmist approach, which is to worry a little bit about what the effects are in dealing with other countries, particularly possible enemies, and particularly when we're talking about matters like nuclear arms and national security. So in tweeting impulsively and goading Kim Jong-un in North Korea, is that a good strategy? is that that's, I think, in places where people may have genuinely deep concerns about what's going on.
Some commentators have contrasted between Donald Trump, the persona, the larger-than-life person, and what he's been up to, and his administration, which they see as more or less kind of in line with what a Republican presidential administration would look like, whoever's the Republican president. Do you see that contrast, or has the Trump persona found its way into the administration as well?
Well, I don't know whether the administration is as conventional. A conventional Republican administration, as perhaps the premise of the question would lead us to believe. It's a pretty eclectic bunch of people. They are Republicans for the most part, but they've been sort of drawn together as almost like the bar at Star Wars. You know, there's this, to a certain extent, some administrations are. But they're not the obvious candidates that you would have if we had another Bush presidency, or we had a Dole presidency, or we had a McCain presidency. They would be reaching from the established benches in the Republican ranks, particularly on the foreign policy side, where Trump has really, because he doesn't know a lot of people in politics and the Republican foreign policy establishment doesn't really want much to do with him, where he's had to reach into the military to use a lot of generals rather than civilian appointments. So I don't think it's a particularly natural Republican administration. But having said that, I think there are a lot of steady hands there who realize that they're only there because it's Trump, not because it's a Republican president, but who have these sort of calming, stabilizing effects on the president and the immediate and his immediate staff around him in the White House. So I think I take issue with the premise of the question in two ways there, but the cumulative effect is that there are some stabilizing people there.
We are chatting with Andrew Taylor, who is a professor of political science at North Carolina State University. A number of the people who were among that really hardline base of support for Donald Trump really wanted him to go to Washington, D.C. and kick things around, knock out the status quo. Do you think those folks are happy about the way things are going, or would they look at Donald Trump and say, you're not doing enough to drain the swamp, using his terms?
Well, and that's where the sort of positive side of disruption, right? And I think there's a part of all of us that would like to see some kind of change, right? And thought that, hey, Trump is an agent of change, and therefore maybe this will work out. Disruption to a certain extent is good. They might not ever be able to be pleased. There may be unrealistic expectations. And to a certain extent, Trump has fed those, and maybe it's his own fault, that draining the swamp, changing the establishment, bringing it to its knees, is just not plausible. And that the most effective kind of change in our system of separated powers and checks and balances and federalism, the most effectual change is actually that can be gradual and sustained rather than that is quick. And so maybe he's not going to please them, but maybe he is. If we look back on 4 and plausibly 8 years of a Trump presidency from the position of the future, we'll look back and say, you know what, there was sort of good change there. And he did sort of drain the swamp, but it was a very slow draining rather than a rapid one. Those people might actually be surprised looking back from the future and by the nature of the change.
We're speaking now a little bit more than a year into the presidency. What are you going to be watching for very closely in year number two?
Well, stylistically, we'll see whether, you know, this kind of frenetic, crazy year that we've had, that Trump sort of chills a little bit, uses the Twitter account a little less frequently, makes decisions that are more conventional, perhaps creates some stability in the staff, and that's been turning over tremendously. With regards to policies, you know, he's got the new budget out. There's an infrastructure proposal. This is the big item he's focusing on now. Where does that go? Will some of the fruits of some of the other things that have been going on in the administration in the past year, for example, the renegotiation of NAFTA, And other issues having to do with foreign policy, relationships with countries like China, his approach to the Iran nuclear deal. Is this all going to – are we going to see some changes in that in the next year? So I'll be looking at that with regards to substantive policy, and then whether we'll have greater stability and more normalcy when it comes to Trump's style of governance.
Well, as this disruptive Trump presidency chugs its way through year number two, we know one person who's going to be watching very closely and assessing and analyzing it is Dr. Andrew Taylor, professor of political science at North Carolina State University. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Mitch.
And we'll have more on Carolina Journal Radio in just a moment.
If you love freedom, we've got great news to share with you. Now you can find the latest news, views, and research from conservative groups across North Carolina all in one place, NorthCarolinaConservative.com. It's one-stop shopping for North Carolina's freedom movement. At NorthCarolinaConservative.com, you'll find links to John Locke Foundation blogs on the day's news, CarolinaJournal.com reporting and quick takes, Carolina Journal radio interviews, TV interviews featuring CJ reporters and Locke Foundation analysts, opinion pieces and reports on higher education from the James G. Martin Center for Academic Renewal, commentary and polling data from the Civitas Institute, and news and views from the North Carolina Family Policy Council. That's right, all in one place, NorthCarolinaConservative.com. That's North Carolina spelled out, conservative.com. NorthCarolinaConservative.com. Try it today.
North Carolina is changing, not just day to day, but hour to hour, minute to minute, even second to second. How can you keep up with the changes, especially the ones that affect you, your family, your home, your job? Make the John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal part of your social media diet. On Facebook, like the John Locke Foundation, like Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal. News, insights, and analysis you'll find nowhere else. Thanks to the experts at the John Locke Foundation, and thanks to the first-class investigative reporting of Carolina Journal. Don't wait for the morning newspaper. Don't wait for the evening news. If it's happening now, it's happening here. The John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal have you covered with up-to-the-second information. Like us on Facebook, the John Locke Foundation, and Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal.
Did you know you can now advance freedom and free markets just by shopping with Amazon? It's true. Online shopping is now a great way to support the John Locke Foundation. Just shop using the Amazon Smile program and designate us, the Locke Foundation, to receive a portion of your purchase amount. That's right. You shop and Amazon donates money to us, the John Locke Foundation. So here's how it works. Log on to smile.amazon.com. Amazon Smile, it's the same Amazon you know. Same products, same prices. But here's what's better. Amazon donates 0.5% of the price of your eligible purchases to us, the John Locke Foundation. So try it. Be sure to designate the Locke Foundation as the nonprofit you want to support. It's that easy. So now, not only will you enjoy what you buy, you'll also support freedom. Don't forget, log on to smile.amazon.com today, buy something nice, and help defend freedom. Help support the John Locke Foundation.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. State lawmakers have questions about mental health services for inmates in county jails. During a recent meeting, Senator Joyce Kravitz questioned Eddie Caldwell of the North Carolina Sheriff's Association.
Number four stresses administration, dispensing, and control of prescription and non-prescription medications. My concern is that this is not happening on a regular basis. I don't know how erratic it is, but I know there was a young woman in my district who died, and she was pregnant as a result of not receiving prescribed medication. And she suffered withdrawal and then a heart attack. Do you know, is this policy, is it supposed to be followed? That ended in a lawsuit, I understand, and cost us a lot of money. So that should never happen, that we should lose someone because they weren't able to get the medication that they had been prescribed. Do you know if this is a procedure that is just rare that it wasn't adhered to, or do you know how often that happens? Can you give me any idea?
We certainly have not done any survey or detailed data analysis, but inmate deaths in the jail are rare, and certainly one is one too many, and the sheriffs don't ever want that to happen, but that's unfortunate when those type situations do. But I do not. I have not heard any complaints or any concerns about inmates not getting their prescriptions.
Lawmakers also wonder about potential problems linked to costs. Senator Ralph Hayes offered his home county, Mitchell, as an example.
The entire expenditure in a year on all of housing, feeding, health care, everything else comes to about $300,000 for the county. It's not hard to see how one serious medical condition that happened across yours could wind up costing more than you spent last year on your entire population.
There are two companies that are providing about two-thirds of the care in jails across the state, so I think there's some economies of scale there. These companies that are using telemedicine, so you don't actually have to have the doctor come into the jail or take the inmate out. There's some economies there. Whether or not other savings and other consolidation could be put into place or not, I don't know. But certainly anything that would save the county money and provide additional and better and more available care to inmates, the sheriffs would certainly support.
You've been listening to highlights from a recent legislative discussion of mental health services in North Carolina's county jails. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
Real influence. You either have it or you don't. And at the John Locke Foundation, we do. And that's not bluster. In a private survey of more than 250 North Carolina political insiders, 87% said we influence them either a great deal or a good amount. So while others talk and complain, we get to work providing research, solutions, and hope. Our team analyzes the pressing issues of the day, jobs, health care, education, and more. We look for effective ways to give you more freedom, more options, more control. Our goal is to transform North Carolina into a growing, thriving economic powerhouse that is the envy of every other state. Our research has actually helped policymakers make decisions that ensure you keep more of what you earn, expand your choice of schools for your kids, widen your job opportunities, and improve your access to doctors. The recipe for stability and a bright future. The John Locke Foundation, we're dedicated to making North Carolina first in freedom. We're dedicated to you.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. If you've ever heard the story that Jews in medieval Europe played a critical role as moneylenders, take note. It's a story based on myth rather than fact. Our next guest has written a book titled The Myth of the Medieval Jewish Moneylender. Julie Mell is Associate Professor of History at North Carolina State University. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
So before we get into the facts of this case, first of all, remind people, what's the story or the myth around medieval Jews in Europe?
Right. The myth is that Jews were merchants in the early Middle Ages when other medieval folks were not commercially active, and that in the High Middle Ages, so that's after 1000, Jews were pushed into money lending, pushed and pulled into money lending, because the church laws on usury forbade Christians from lending money on interest. So this is the myth in a nutshell. There are a couple of other aspects to it as well, because the Jews provided then this economic role for Europe, they really helped European economic development in the 12th and 13th centuries, which laid the groundwork, the institutional framework for the later commercial expansion in the early modern and modern periods. And along with that, the second part of this myth is that because they provided credit at a time when the church outlawed usury, they suffered an anti-Semitic backlash for that activity. So even while they were serving Europe's needs, they suffered for it.
So this is the myth. Your book addresses this and tells us it is a myth. So what'd you find?
Right. I've found that there are a lot of complicated reasons for why we have told this story that go back to the 19th century, back to arguments over Jewish emancipation in Europe in the latter 19th century, and to assumptions also from the 19th century about what medieval European economy looked like. The assumption was that there Europe was principally an agrarian economy of barter. The assumption was that Jews were a commercialized people well before other European nations. What I found is that the Jewish population was more or less similar to the Christian urban population. And as many economic historians in the 20th century have shown, credit was widely used in Europe throughout the 13th century by all parties, including the church. Even with their usury laws, they needed a way to get those tithes to Rome, the tithes collected by the Pope to Rome, and they employed Italian merchants to do so. And of course, interest was made along the way. I found in particular in studying the Jewish population that most of the Jewish population was too poor to have been involved in professional money lending at all. So that the kind of stereotypes about Jews and money and commerce are really just that, stereotypes, ones that have stayed with us for a long time.
That is the voice of Julie Mell, Associate Professor of History at NC State University and author of the book, The Myth of the Medieval Jewish Moneylender. As you were describing the myth, some of it sounded, as you said, just like stereotypes that people would have about Jewish people, some parts of which would be negative, but some parts of it were positive, this idea that they played this critical role in the economy. How did this all come together? You mentioned the 19th century. Why did this myth come to be?
Right. So what I call the myth, or what is still today the standard historical narrative that you'd find in Jewish history textbooks, shares a lot of the same presumptions that anti-Semitic stereotypes do. So there's a shared common ground. Where they differ is in the way in which they value that presumed Jewish activity of lending. So from a liberal economic perspective, one that's philo-Semitic, that is, that's sympathetic to the Jewish population, this role, this economic function of the Jews is perceived as something beneficial to Europe. If you start from an anti-Semitic perspective and one that is not liberal economic, but let's say like the fascist parties of mid-20th century Europe, the Nazis included, they would see this as a detrimental to the European economy.
So having all of this information now, the facts of the case as you spell them out, how is it helpful moving forward to know that this was a story, this was invented centuries after the fact, and there's really a myth rather than based on fact?
Right. Let me back up just a little bit, if I may, and finish answering your question about the 19th century. So as Jewish emancipation was beginning to be debated in Germany, and when a stock market crash happened in the 1870s, some of the liberal economists of the day, political economists, such as Wilhelm Rauscher, wrote arguments in favor of Jewish emancipation, and they used this as their key example. So these arguments become part then of the general academic discourse on economic development. They get picked up by Max Weber, Werner Sombart, and transmitted then to whole generations of sociologists and historians. Why is it important to recognize this as a myth and to change it? It's important because those stereotypes, the anti-Semitic stereotypes, are still with us. And I think only by acknowledging the false quality of the myth, whether it's told in a philo-Semitic vein or an anti-Semitic vein, are we really going to be able to change our understanding, not only of Jewish history, but of European history as well. I have a second volume to this work that then takes up that question and says, well, how does this revision of Jewish history change our understanding of European history and of European society? And I look at things like the usury debates and how we actually understand what the church was doing or those Christian intellectuals were doing when they were writing about and legislating on economic practice.
Well, we have barely scratched the surface. If you'd like to learn more about the facts and not just the myth, the title of the book is The Myth of the Medieval Jewish Moneylender. The author of the book is Julie Mell, Associate Professor of History at North Carolina State University. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
We'll have more on Carolina Journal Radio in just a moment.
A commitment to truth and transparency in government. That is the mission of Carolina Journal, and we are proud to deliver. And now, proud to tell you, the North Carolina Press Association has honored two members of our team with awards for reporting and writing. That's right, we really do deliver award-winning journalism. We shine the light on government spending, reveal the truth about boondoggles, and dig deep into programs paid for with your tax money. We keep you in the know in a way other media outlets don't. And our reach and influence are growing. Through all of our outlets, we reach more than 1 million North Carolinians each month. So make sure you're one of them. Our monthly print edition arrives in your mailbox every month. Our online daily news site, CarolinaJournal.com, has fresh stories, opinion pieces, and more. The award-winning Carolina Journal team, our reporters make government accountable to you. Call 1-866-JLF-INFO for your free subscription. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Donna Martinez. It sits near Elizabeth City in eastern North Carolina. The $400 million Amazon wind farm consists of more than 100 turbines that generate electricity, of course, from wind. But after more than a year of operation, questions remain over the farm's potential interference with the U.S. Navy's radar facility, questions that have also been raised by leaders of the North Carolina General Assembly. Carolina Journal has reported extensively on the wind farm, with the latest update published just days ago at CarolinaJournal.com. Rick Henderson is editor-in-chief. He joins us to talk about the latest installment. Welcome back.
Thank you, Donna.
The wind farm itself, it's called the Amazon Wind Farm. Does that mean Amazon owns this?
Amazon basically purchased the rights to claim the electricity that's generated from the facility there. So, yes, Amazon is technically the owner of it, yes.
Is there any taxpayer involvement in this, Rick, or any potential for taxpayers to bear the burdens of the costs or anything like that?
Well, part of that depends on how the energy itself is sold to the power grid. There were some incentives involved. There are federal tax incentives that were involved in the process to begin with that existed for more than 20 years. This is availability to people to get tax write-offs if they built renewable energy facilities. Also, there were some state tax incentives involved in this process, but those have since expired. But the big question is, if the state government says that Duke Energy or whoever has to provide a certain amount of power from wind sources than connecting to the grid would be a cost. Now, that's generally speaking. If we're talking about this project in particular, no, because Amazon is claiming that all the energy from this is going to be used to offset the energy that it uses at one of its data centers up in Virginia. Now, this is kind of bogus. This is kind of like the climate offsets that Al Gore used to do to talk about that, it didn't matter if he was flying around the world because his house was using less electricity. And so therefore the two offset one another.
This is all part of the whole green energy movement.
Yeah, it really is.
Renewable sources, et cetera.
I mean, we sort of jokingly said this is Amazon's bought the naming rights to the power that's coming from this, from this, wind facility. But really it's unclear if any of this, how much, if any, of this facility's power is actually getting to the grid. We just know that it generates a certain amount because that's recorded by the U.S. government. But whether it's getting to the grid or what price or anything like that, we just don't know.
It's been in operation for more than a year now. Rick, the U.S. Navy has been questioning this facility for some time, even before this was actually up and running. What's the Navy's concern here?
The Navy's concern is that it operates a huge radar array up in the Hampton Roads area of Virginia. And that radar, those radar dishes are pointed towards Central and South America, especially in waterways. And what they're trying to do is intercept contraband coming from Central and South America to
drug
the
runners.
U.S. Drug runners largely, but other forms of contraband could be involved too. I mean, potentially could be even, you know, weapons and stuff like that. You just don't know what's there. But the wind itself, that the vibration from the wind, if it's within a certain radius or range of those radar dishes, can actually interfere with the operations of the radar. And the Navy's been concerned about that since before this wind facility went up.
That's fascinating to me because one would presume that when the federal government, particularly the military, becomes involved in something, that their viewpoint would take precedence over someone else's viewpoint. But this is now operating. So what gives there?
The Obama administration's Defense Department basically decided that it wanted to get heavily involved in renewable energy, using the military resources to go greener, if you will. So because the military owns large parcels of property and can quite often might have areas that are unoccupied, that have no other use, and could be houses, could house solar farms or wind farms or things like that. But what the Department of Defense basically said was that if there's a possibility for a use of renewable energy, even if it interferes with military operations, then in some cases, the military is just going to have to suck it up and let this facility go on to make the military greener.
Do we know if there really is an interference with the Navy's radar, or is this just speculative?
We're fairly certain that there's something going on, because basically the way that the Navy specced out what the facility is called, the relocatable over the horizon radar facility, and Rother is the acronym for it. And when they were specking out Rother, they basically said that anything that was within approximately a radius of about something like about 30 to 40 miles could possibly interfere with it. Now, the Amazon facility is 22 miles from Rother, so some edges of it are. So it's fairly certain it's within that radius. And in fact, there was testimony that was taken on Capitol Hill about this. And one of the persons who testified against this at the time was John Kelly, who is now President Trump's chief of staff. Formerly was head of Homeland Security, but at the time he actually was in charge of the Southern Command, which is the military operation that sort of defends this portion of the world from looking south from any sort of foreign invasion or any sort of national security issues. And so General Kelly said, this is a problem and we should stop it. But the Obama administration wouldn't relent.
So fast forward into the Trump administration, and this facility is close enough. The wind farm is close enough to the Rother, as you described it, that North Carolina's legislative leaders are expressing concern about this, and they've actually written to the Trump administration.
Yes, Tim Moore, the Speaker of the House, Phil Berger, the Leader of the Senate, wrote to the Trump administration asking to see if there wasn't some way to, if nothing else, overrule the Obama administration's earlier directive on this. The Navy itself is coming out with its own study sometime this spring with an update on potential interference, and we'll see what happens from there. There are members of the General Assembly who like this sort of thing. There's a big, important race going on in that area involving incumbent Bob Steinberg, who's running for he's the House member who's running for the state Senate, and he's a big supporter of renewable energy, and so but he's got some opposition that's got to give him some troubles. So that's going to be an interesting thing to see how that plays out.
And as you mentioned, then elected officials certainly in that area knowing about this project and taking positions one way or another. We've got a county commissioner in Currituck County right in that area who has big-time concerns. He's actually a former Navy pilot.
Right, exactly. And he's Paul Beaumont. And he toured the Amazon wind farm recently. Basically, said he wants it shut down. He wants it to be taken care of entirely, but he can't do that because it's not in his jurisdiction. So, what he would like to see is if the county commission couldn't take up some sort of a resolution which would change the local zoning regulations so that wind farms would not be an allowable use if someone was looking for a variation. So that's what they're trying to do there. Other counties have attempted to do that. And they can't do it after the fact. If some land has already been promised, or there's been some sort of a purposeful attempt for someone to locate a wind farm somewhere, you can't rescind that. But counties can proactively say, we're not going to allow wind farms or solar farms.
Lastly, Rick, is Amazon concerned about this, or are they completely out of this discussion?
Amazon has been very, very quiet about this whole thing. They have not been communicative. They continue to say that they're green and that they're using this electricity to offset what's going on at their data center. But if they actually were, then every time the wind wasn't blowing enough, then their data center would shut down. So, of course, this is just pretty much bogus corporate PR, if you will, from Amazon.
We've been talking with Rick Henderson, who's editor-in-chief. Rick, thank you very much.
Thank you, Donna.
That's all the time we have for the show this week. Thank you for listening. On behalf of my co-host, Mitch Kokai, I'm Donna Martinez. Please join us again next week for another edition of Carolina Journal Radio.
Carolina Journal Radio is a program of the John Locke Foundation. To learn more about the John Locke Foundation, including donations that support programs like Carolina Journal Radio, send email to development@johnlocke.org or call 1-866-JLF-INFO. That's 1-866-553-4636.
Carolina Journal Radio is a co-production of the John Locke Foundation, North Carolina's free market think tank, and Carolina Broadcasting System, Incorporated. All opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of advertisers or the station. For more information about the show or other programs and services of the John Locke Foundation, visit johnlocke.org or call us toll-free at 866-JLF-INFO. We'd like to thank our wonderful radio affiliates across North Carolina and our sponsors. From all of us at Carolina Journal Radio, thank you for listening, and please join us again next week.